A young American woman stands in an English garden, her eyes bright with possibility, refusing a proposal from a wealthy lord. Why would anyone turn down security, status, and genuine affection? Because Isabel Archer believes she deserves something more, not a better man, but a grander destiny. She wants to choose her own path, to experience life on her own terms before settling into any predetermined role. This moment captures the beating heart of Henry James's 1881 masterpiece. What happens when our most cherished ideals collide with a world designed to exploit them? Isabel's journey from spirited independence to suffocating constraint reveals an uncomfortable truth. Sometimes the freedom to choose leads us straight into our own cage. Her transformation from confident idealist to trapped wife illuminates the complex relationship between independence and obligation, between romantic notions and harsh realities, between the person we imagine ourselves to be and the choices we actually make when tested. Isabel arrives at Garden Court like a breath of fresh air. Three men, an elderly American banker, his dying son Ralph, and an English aristocrat sit enjoying afternoon tea when this dark-haired young woman appears. "Oh, I hoped there would be a lord. It's just like a novel," she exclaims upon meeting Lord Warderton, revealing both her romantic imagination and that distinctly American directness that seems almost rude among weathered stone and ancient tapestries. Raised in Albany after her father's financial collapse, Isabel educated herself through unrestricted reading in her grandmother's library. While her sisters followed conventional paths, she developed a reputation for intelligence that intimidated suitors. She possessed what James calls a great fund of life, preferring direct experience to secondhand knowledge, though her actual experience remained almost entirely theoretical. England delights her like a child discovering a pop-up book has become real. Yet this enchantment masks a crucial vulnerability. Isabel's romantic notions about European culture come entirely from literature. She believes she can navigate this complex world through intelligence and integrity alone, never suspecting that her very independence might become the weapon used against her. Isabel's independent spirit emerges when she rejects Lord Warburton's proposal. Despite his wealth, title, and genuine affection, she declines, insisting she doesn't wish to marry anyone presently. She can't articulate why, only that something in her resists this conventional path. When American suitor Caspar Goodwood follows her to Europe, she declares, "I don't want to marry. I want to be free." He reluctantly agrees to give her space, but predicts she'll eventually marry someone else, a prophetic comment. Then comes the transformation. Isabel's uncle dies, leaving her £70,000. This inheritance, secretly arranged by cousin Ralph, who wanted to put a little wind in her sails, gives Isabel financial independence to pursue her ideals. She believes to be rich was a virtue because it was to be able. But here's the cruel irony. The fortune meant to guarantee her freedom becomes the very thing that compromises it. Wealth makes Isabel visible to those who would exploit her, transforming her from an interesting young woman into a target. Isabel incorporates her wealth into her self-image as a part of her better self, never realizing others see it as an opportunity for their own advancement. Enter Madame Merle, a sophisticated American expatriate who becomes Isabel's mentor. Their philosophical debates reveal crucial differences. When Isabel insists possessions are external to one's true self, Madame Merle counters, "There's no such thing as an isolated man or woman. We're each made up of some cluster of appurtenances." This isn't abstract philosophy. It's how Madame Merle views the world. Through her, Isabel meets Gilbert Osmond, an American in Florence who presents himself as a refined connoisseur above worldly ambition. His hilltop villa contains an ominous detail Isabel misses. Once you were in, you would need an act of energy to get out. Everything appeals to her romantic sensibility: his taste, apparent indifference to society, cultivation of beauty. What Isabel doesn't see is the calculated manipulation. Madame Merle reveals to Osmond, "I want you, of course, to marry her." They're targeting Isabel's fortune. When Osmond declares his love, Isabel experiences the dread of having, in this case too, to choose and decide. After traveling for a year, she accepts despite universal objections. Having seen life, it no longer seems such an inviting expanse. One must choose a corner and cultivate that. The crushing irony, Isabel, who prized independence above everything, has chosen the one man who will systematically destroy it. 3 years into marriage, Isabel's life has become unrecognizable. Osmond's egotism lay hidden like a serpent in a bank of flowers. His contempt for the world masked obsession. He craved society's recognition of his superiority. While Isabel imagined aristocratic life meant the union of great knowledge with great liberty, for Osmond, it was altogether a thing of forms. He expected her mind to be his, attached to his own, like a small garden plot to a deer park. Isabel now understands Osmond married her for money and position. Her resistance revealed his scorn. The real offense was her having a mind of her own at all. Their marriage became a performance of harmony, while privately existing as cold warfare. Their Roman residence, Palazzo Rocanera, literally Black Rock Palace, symbolizes this perfectly, imposing outside, suffocating within. Isabel accidentally witnesses an intimate moment between Osmond and Madame Merle, their posture suggesting disturbing familiarity. The Countess Gemini reveals that Pansy is actually their illegitimate daughter. Why didn't Osmond marry her? Because she had no money. Isabel realizes Madame Merle had married her, orchestrating everything to secure Isabel's fortune for Pansy's future. When Ralph is dying, Isabel defies Osmond's prohibition and rushes to Garden Court. At his bedside, she confesses she knows Osmond married her for money. Ralph comforts her, noting she was ground in the very mill of the conventional, despite wanting to look at life for herself. With his last breath, he whispers that she has been adored. Isabel cries out, "Oh, my brother!" After Ralph's funeral, Caspar Goodwood confronts her. "You're the most unhappy of women, and your husband's the deadliest of fiends." He urges her to leave Osmond. When Goodwood kisses her, like white lightning, a flash that spread and spread again and stayed, Isabel momentarily surrenders to denied passion. But when darkness returns, she darts away, seeing now a very straight path. 2 days later, Goodwood learns Isabel has left for Rome. The novel ends with this ambiguous departure. Has she returned to Osmond out of duty, or found freedom in choosing her own fate? Does her return represent defeat or a complex victory? The triumph of moral responsibility over personal happiness. Isabel Archer's journey reveals an uncomfortable truth. True freedom isn't avoiding commitment, but accepting responsibility for our choices and their consequences. She began believing independence meant standing outside society's constraints. She ends understanding that freedom exists within limitations, not in their absence. How often do we confuse freedom with the absence of constraint? Isabel's story suggests this kind of freedom is ultimately hollow. Real freedom comes from making choices with full awareness of their implications, and then living with those choices, even when they're difficult. In our culture that celebrates endless possibility, Isabel's story offers different wisdom. Sometimes, the most profound freedom is found not in escaping our circumstances, but in choosing to engage with them fully, to take responsibility for the life we've created, even when that life looks nothing like what we imagined. That's the portrait James completes, not of innocence preserved, but of wisdom earned through suffering, not of freedom as escape, but as the courage to choose our obligations.